Hello, and welcome to another edition of Brussels Sprouts. I'm Andrea Kendall Taylor.
And I'm Jim Townsend.
And we're so glad you can join us. We hope that all of our Brussels Sprouts listeners are continuing to do well with everything that's going on as social distancing continues and the teleworking and the distance learning. But we wanted to shift our focus today away from COVID and to another issue that was in the news, especially last week, and that is arms control and the Open Skies Treaty. Last week, the Trump administration announced its intent to withdraw from the Open Skies Treaty, starting a six-month clock to final withdraw. And as most of our listeners know, that was a treaty that was signed by George W.H. Bush, and it allows the United States, NATO allies, Russia, and other European countries to fly over each other's territories and take images to observe military forces and facilities. It was something that was established to build confidence and increase transparency in the Euro-Atlantic region. But the Trump administration's announcement of its intent to withdraw continues the United States down a path that is leading to, an unraveling of the arms control regime. And so we wanted to bring in two fantastic guests today to help us make sense of this decision, what it means for U.S.-Russia relations, the future of arms control, and how it's affecting U.S. relations with European allies and partners. And so with that, I really want to extend a heartfelt welcome to Steve Pfeiffer and Anna Weislander.
Thank you.
Happy to be here.
Really quick introductions for both. I think a lot of our listeners are probably familiar with both Steve and Anna, but very quickly, Steve Pfeiffer is a non-resident senior fellow in the Arms Control and Non-Proliferation Initiative and the Center on the United States and Europe at the Brookings Institution. He's also a William J. Perry Fellow at the Center for International Security and Cooperation at Stanford University, and a longtime Foreign Service officer, I think over 25 years as a Foreign Service officer, including serving as a Deputy Assistant Secretary of State with responsibilities for Russia and Ukraine. He was our ambassador to Ukraine. He served as a senior advisor on the National Security Council, so a wealth of knowledge and experience. And we also are joined by Anna Weislander, and Anna is the director for Northern Europe at the Atlantic Council. She also serves as the chairman of the Institute for Security and Development Policy and secretary general of the Swedish Defense Association, and she also has a long career serving various positions in the Swedish Defense Ministry. So again, welcome to both of you. Maybe just to jump in, Steve, to start with you, maybe you can just kind of give us a little background, tell us a little bit more about the Open Skies Treaty, what it does, what value it serves for the United States, and kind of how you see it fitting into the arms control regime more broadly.
Yeah, well, the Open Skies Treaty, it was one of this package of measures to promote arms control, transparency, and confidence building in Europe that we've seen over the last 25 years. And basically what the treaty does is every participant, there were 34 countries, they'll soon be just 33 once the United States withdraws. But the treaty basically allows every country, you have two quotas. One is the number of overflights that you can conduct over other countries each year. And then there's a similar number, which is the number of flights that you have to accept each year. And the idea is that countries can use aircraft with cameras, and the cameras are certified as in compliance with the standards of the Open Skies Treaty. They can overfly the other country. They can have a mechanism then to observe military facilities, military activities, and that helps sort of avoid a situation in which there might be miscalculation or wrong assumptions about what some country may be doing on the military side. And it's had a very, it's been running now since 2002. It actually, in a way, favors the United States because the way the structure of the quotas are, between 2002 and 2016, the United States did about 190 flights over Russia, and Russia did in the same period about 75 flights over the United States. But it contributes to this sense of confidence building, transparency, that you have a better idea of what other countries are doing, so you have to worry less about possible military activities.
Anna, maybe the same set of questions for you too, bringing the Europe lens. I mean, how is this treaty viewed in Europe, and what was the reaction in Europe to the U.S. announcement to withdraw?
Well, I mean, the Open Skies Treaty has been part of the European security architecture as it developed after the fall of the Berlin Wall. And it has been very important because European security, for one, of course, dependent on the US, but also consisting of a range of small countries that are really dependent on the fact that there are rules, there is some kind of order, and, you know, we can work towards transparency and trust as much as we can with the big countries. So it has been part of a package which has been very important for us. And therefore, once we heard the rumors already in fall 2019, a few months ago, that this was going on, there was concern because this is also one of the paths that we're always looking at in Europe, being so close to Russia. You know, what kind of tracks are there for dialogue, for cooperation, for actually meeting each other? There are not that many left, but this has been one activity. And when this decision came from the US, I think most countries felt that, of course, it's not perfect, but it's still functional, still useful. And the majority of countries would like the US to actually not in the end leave the Open Skies Treaty, but come back to it. I mean, there's a 6-month period now, and we hope that the US will reconsider this.
Well, that's very helpful, both of those descriptions, because the Open Skies Treaty, I don't think, is as well known among a lot of folks, except for specialists. And so those are some very good discussions. But, you know, I'm going to take a position that I normally don't take just to, you know, explore this a bit more. We're for sure, and I'm a supporter of the Open Skies Treaty and confidence building measures and transparency and stability and all that comes with arms control. It's got a very important role in national security, both for us and for our allies, and we have to do these things together. But let me play the devil's advocate and say, so what would you advise Biden to do in the sense that he comes back in and he's still dealing with a treaty problem? And what I mean by that is, it's we, as the United States dealing with Russia, there comes a point where you have to do something. You can't just continue along as if nothing's happening and the Russians nibble here and they nibble there and they nibble there. In fact, if you read the State Department press release about the concerns that we've had with Russia, it tells a pretty disturbing story. So, you know, putting Trump aside and all the spin and politics, if you're Joe Biden and you come in, you've got to decide whether you want to just run and jump right back into the treaty, or do you try to deal with the problems within the treaty? You know, what do you do with the Russians to try to get compliance sharper than it is and to stop the games playing? So if you were advising Biden, what would you say about the open skies? What do you think the approach should be?
Well, let me take the first crack at that. I mean, I think actually having the treaty is in the United States' interest. You know, first of all, the imagery that comes from open skies is unclassified. That's very different from American military satellite imagery, which is highly classified and you rarely see. Second, it gives other countries in Europe the chance to play a part. I mean, they're active collectors. They fly over open skies flights. It's not just the United States. And third, you can also use these in a political way. So for example, in the last 6 years, the United States, and I believe Canada as well, have used open skies overflights over Ukraine near the line of contact with the part of Donbas that's occupied by Russian and Russian proxy forces to send a political signal. So there's advantages there. Now, it's true the Russians have violated the treaty. For example, they limit the amount of time that other planes can conduct an overflight over the Kaliningrad exclave. And they also limit some flights along the southern border along with Georgia. But instead of throwing out the entire treaty, what the United States has done already is impose reciprocal restrictions on the Russians. So for example, the Russians now they're not permitted to conduct open skies flights over Hawaii. There's some limitations on Alaska. So I would argue that rather than throwing out the treaty, you keep the treaty and its advantages, but you maintain these reciprocal restrictions on the Russians, basically to deny them some advantages of the treaty that balance out what they've denied to the United States and other members.
Right. Anna.
Well, I think those are great arguments. And I would also advise to keep the treaty, because we are not in a position now where it's easy to make new deals. Even you in theory could make better deals, so to say. This is a hard time to do that, because the level of trust and confidence is so low. So I would rather work within the treaty. And also a broader argument I would say is that it's an irony in this, because the US creates greater uncertainty when it leaves this treaty in a region like Northern Europe, where the US, on the other hand, has given formal security guarantees for the region, so to say. So it's not really a logic in there. Why create a greater uncertainty in a region where it's better that there is a level of trust which works in a deterrence direction? Where you can have, I mean, Sweden, we flew over Russia in April 2019. They have been flying over us and so on. And we are part of intelligence and surveillance and reconnaissance system in that area. It works, I mean, pretty well from our point of view. And we appreciate that there is a point of contact with Russia in this, because there aren't that many that we can work with. And that has a value as such, even though it's not perfect, of course, it could be better, but it's still, what's the alternative? Just to deconstruct and have nothing? That's the worst alternative in this sense, because it creates instability and uncertainty, and that's not what we need.
And then maybe just to kind of follow on the European perspective. So this, you know, the United States, the Trump administration withdrew from JCPOA, and that's been a major kind of source of tension in the transatlantic relationship. The United States has withdrawn from the INF treaty. There was more European consensus and kind of clear evidence that Russia was in violation of that treaty, and the United States then through NATO managed to come up with a unified NATO statement in support of the U.S. decision. But so where on that big spectrum, kind of source of tension versus some agreement about the extent of Russian violations of the treaty, is Europe on open skies? Is this going to be another kind of source of friction? Is it a big deal? Is it not a big deal? Kind of where do you see this playing out in the transatlantic relationship?
My feeling is that there was more consensus on the INF treaty than there is on the open skies, actually. Because there were also more consultation in a longer process already, I think, from the, as I recall it, from the Obama administration on the lack of compliance from the Russian side on the INF treaty. So that was more a mature process. And I believe that for the open skies, it has not been the same. Of course, everyone agrees that Russia is not complying perfectly, but still there is an underlying feeling in Europe, that's my sense, that it is still functional. We need these kind of safety net of treaties that work. We have also the Conventional Forces Agreement Treaty, what will happen with the new START. There is a lot of uncertainty adding on, and that's it undermines the rule-based order, and that's a problem for Europe.
Yeah, I just might add, I mean, everything I've seen suggests that all NATO allies support continued operation of the Open Skies Treaty, despite the Russian problems. And the treaty, I mean, although it allows overflights over the United States and Canada, this is a treaty that was first and foremost about enhancing security and confidence in Europe. And it's one of those areas where I would think that Washington probably owes a little bit of deference to the views of our European allies and our European partners. But I think what we've seen is just one more case where the Trump administration really gives short shrift to those views and doesn't really take them and give them the full consideration that they merit.
And Steve, what have you seen in terms of reaction from Moscow? I mean, what was the Russian response? And I mean, is this just kind of another piece in this long downward slide in U.S.-Russia relations?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think this is one more problem, but given the state of the U.S.-Russia relationship already, I mean, there are many more issues troubling that relationship that are much larger. Russia's aggression against Ukraine, Russian interference in American domestic politics, bigger issues are in the arms control world, like, what happens with the nuclear arms control and the New START treaty. So it's a problem, but I think it's a relatively marginal problem to a relationship that's already at its lowest point since the end of the Cold War. And the specific reactions of Moscow have been a little bit mixed. I mean, the initial reaction was sort of suggested that Russia would continue to participate. But then I think there may have been a little bit of a warning shot saying, well, they'll want to see what happens. And I think some concern on the Russians' part that if NATO allies continue to share the information with the United States, even though the United States is outside of the treaty, that causes an issue for the Russians.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure the Russians have made up their mind, and there's sort of probably a debate going on in Moscow now. On the one hand, remaining in the treaty allows them to basically take the high road. The Americans have left the treaty, and they can charge the Americans had no good reason to do so. They're still in. On the other hand, the Russians have to do the calculation is without them having now the advantage of overflights over the United States, and it's limited just to Europe, does that give them still sufficient cause to remain within the treaty? And my guess is they probably have not yet made that decision. And they're probably waiting to see what happens over the next 6 months. I mean, the United States has just given its notice of intention. There may be an additional issue here, which is in the National Defense Authorization Act. It has language that says before the United States gives notices of intention to withdraw, there has to be a 120-day consultation period with Congress. And the administration blew right by that. Now, when the president signed the National Defense Authorization Act, there was a signing statement that's saying, well, this might be an unwarranted intrusion on the president's ability to conduct foreign policy. But there is potentially an issue here between Congress and the executive branch that has not yet played out.
Well, it's interesting trying to figure out what the Russians will do with this. I mean, it's, as we all know, it's a game of chess, and there's a move and there's a counter move. And I think you're right. I think why should they do anything given that November is just right around the corner in a lot of ways. And let's just see what happens with a new president. And so on that point, just to kind of widen the aperture a little bit, just talk about the future of arms control, and where arms control is going. The open skies, of course, was an idea hatched during the Eisenhower administration, and that finally came to fruition in this century. And then we had, of course, the INF Treaty from the 1980s. We've got START, which is an offspring of SALT II. And so much of our arms control, our network, our safety net of treaties, like Anna said, so much of that comes from the last century, the relationship between our two countries in the last century, the politics, the military capability and technology. And the people who did that, who did those treaties, and I used to work at the ACTA, and I know how it's, I know what a grind this can be as we look to the future. And I keep talking about a Biden administration, but whoever is president, I mean, if you're looking to the future, you're looking to the future of arms control, what does that look like? We've had one glimmer, which was the Trump saying that, well, look, in terms of START II, we're not going to have our new START. We're not going to have something that's not going to involve China. China's got to be part of it. Of course, that could have been a poison pill, because then you could say, well, China's not going to do it, so we're going to just not have arms control. And I hope that's not the future. But certainly arms control, as we look ahead, is going to have to be different. It's going to have to look different. We're going to have to go about it in a different way. What do you think it's going to look like?
Maybe I'll start. I think the starting point is, arms control is not an end in itself. It's a tool. It's a tool that you use to advance American national security and the security of our allies and our partners.
Right.
I think from what we've seen in the last 3 years, the Trump administration probably has, I'd describe it as a philosophical antipathy towards arms control.
Right.
And it goes back to, for example, I think the approach that John Bolton, when he was national security advisor, he was very open about this by saying, I don't like arms control. It constrains American forces. It constrains American options. My argument would be is that sometimes accepting constraints on American forces and American options is worthwhile because it results in constraints on the other side's forces and options. So I do worry. I think the New START Treaty remains very much in the U.S. interest. Extension to my mind would be a no-brainer. First of all, If you extend it out for 5 years, that constrains Russian strategic forces for an additional 5 years. That's a good thing. Second, it would continue the flow of information that we get from data exchanges and notifications and inspections. And in some cases, if that information goes away, we don't have an alternate way to get that information. But third, we get all of that. We get the limits on Russia, we get the information without having to make a single change in American modernization plans, because the American plans were designed to fit within New START's limits.
Right.
This should be pretty easy to do. But instead, what we've seen in the Trump administration saying is every time they're asked about New START extension, they say, well, no, we want to have this trilateral negotiation, which they've been talking about now for more than a year, bringing in China and including all nuclear weapons, not just the deployed weapons that are limited by New START. And I think bringing in China is a lot of a goal, and getting to a negotiation with Russia that talks about all American Russian nuclear weapons is also a lot of a goal. But it's not going to happen. China's been adamant that they're not prepared to join the negotiation, and their rationale has a certain logic. They say, look, in China we have maybe 300 nuclear weapons. That's less than one-tenth the number that the United States and Russia have in their active stockpiles, and it doesn't even count retired American and Russian weapons. And the Russians have said for 9 years that they're prepared to talk about all nuclear weapons if the United States will talk about certain issues. And at the top of that list is missile defense. And the Trump administration has made very clear in its missile defense posture review that any kind of limits on missile defense are no-go. So there are two great, you know, objectives, but in one case, China has said no. And in the other case, I think the Trump administration has limited itself in a way that would prevent it from getting into that negotiation. So these are very complex issues. And in any case, I'd argue that extending New START and then trying to bring China in and get to all nuclear weapons, you know, it's going to be easier to get China in, and it's going to be easier to get to a point when you're talking about all nuclear weapons if you have New START there as a foundation. If it goes away, then you have to go back and reinvent that treaty as well as tackling these other very complex issues.
Right.
Well, I agree. If you look at it from, I'm in Sweden, small country, you know, we would have strong ideological positions on nuclear-free world and so on. That's usually the position. But I mean, nothing happens if the great powers don't have an interest, as Stephen says, of pursuing and sitting down and negotiating some kind of constraints, mutual constraints, and realizing that this is in the interest of both. And do we have that situation now? I don't see it. That's my problem with this, right, including China. I fully agree there. I mean, I can't see it. Why would China sit down and put constraints on themselves, looking at the power balance as it is? That's why the US shouldn't leave the treaties they have, because you still have superiority in a lot of these fields. But in a few years, you will have perhaps, you know, you have the China push for hypersonic weapons, for robotics, for drones, for these new kind of weapon systems, and they come up to rise. And if you don't have a grip on the arms control regime at that point, I think it will be a very difficult situation for the US. I mean, we had the Cuban Missile Crisis, right, that led to the non-proliferation treaty, because it was at the brink and both parts understood that this is, we need to put constraints on each other, otherwise we will blow this world up. But you have to have these breaking points in history which are really to the point in order to get the parties to sit down if they're rivals in a global power competition game.
And that breaking point.
Let me add just one additional point on China, which is President Trump first proposed in December of 2018, so that's almost a year and a half ago, this idea of a negotiation bringing China in. And he then directed the administration more than a year ago to think about an approach. For a year, we've heard nothing about an American proposal or even the outline of a proposal. And I think it comes down to the fact that it's really hard to do, because neither the United States nor Russia are prepared to reduce down to the Chinese level of 300 weapons. Neither the United States nor Russia are prepared to say, okay, China, you can build up to our level of 3,800, 4,300 nuclear weapons. And so are we going to try to ask the Chinese to accept an unequal treaty? This is a really difficult question. And the fact that we've seen no proposal, no outline, suggests to me that the administration is having a hard time coming up with what this thing would look like.
So then does that make a case that, I mean, to make a case for extending discussions more under the strategic stability umbrella? So if you start to broaden the basket of issues that we're talking about to things particularly like space and cyber, then would you see that as a first step to getting China at the table as kind of an entree, at least to get them interested in negotiations and holding these discussions that could then lead to something down the line?
Yeah, well, I would argue extend New START. That gives you an additional 5 years to tackle some really tough questions, and then do strategic stability talks with both Russia and China separately. Maybe at some point you could bring them together. But you then talk in those talks, you talk about nuclear weapons, missile defense, conventional strike, hypersonic, talk about everything. And it may not be possible to spin off particular negotiations on some of those issues, but just having the conversation sometimes can be useful in terms of helping to understand what's the other side's concerns, and maybe you can allay some of those concerns just in that process of engagement. And unfortunately, the last 3 years, you know, we've had, you know, a couple of very short engagements, but there has not been a process of ongoing engagement with either the Russians, and I think that's a lot of that is on the fault of the Trump administration. It's been harder with China because the Chinese have sort of shied away from these talks, but trying to engage in those talks. But I think in both cases, it's better to do it on the basis of having New START still in place.
You know, Marshall Billingsley made a statement a couple of days ago talking about, I can't remember his exact words, but certainly laying out this tactic that the Reagan did this, but also now let's say Trump is well saying that, look, we're going to spend you into oblivion. You know, you want to see a nuclear arms race? We'll give you one, you know, that kind of thing. You know, Reagan, of course, did that with Star Wars and that type of thing. But it was a whole different framework with Reagan. But still, it's this idea that you can get them to the table and make a better deal by scaring them and saying, we will bury you. And we've done it once before, and we'll do it again. So that's kind of where the Trump administration is, which I don't think, as we've all said, I don't think that's going to work at all.
And when you talk about spending them into oblivion, I think Mr. Billingsley missed the part about COVID-19.
That's exactly what I was just going to say.
Where is going to come from?
Exactly. Yeah. And what will be the public appetite? I mean, for both question to Stephen and Anna, to sustain defense spending in both the United States and Europe. How does that reality fit with the reality of COVID-19?
Yeah.
And then I think the other twist in there too is we've been doing a lot of work on Russia-China relations. And as they're increasingly cooperating, sharing technology, you know, will they be able to jointly innovate faster than the United States can do on its own? And so there's that reality too of how does the United States compete if we're up against increasing cooperation on the defense and military front between Russia and China? I feel like our ability to innovate at the same rate as Russia and China combined is also what would be a significant challenge. So yeah, just your thoughts on kind of what this whole mentality about the United States being able to maintain and outspend Russia and China. How does that fit with what you see as the practical realities on the ground?
I just want to say first that I think that, you know, the Trump administration has a challenge in that if they continue to pursue or say that they are pursuing global leadership, but what we are watching is a lot of, you know, is it deconstruction or reconstruction? And when will they move into the phase of reconstructing if this world order does not fit American interests the way? We are all watching that. And I think we are, with COVID-19, you know, the EU's official rhetoric is that this is a leaderless world. You know, there has been not little US leadership, there has been none. That's the official line of the European Union now. So that's the world we are facing when it comes to, you know, will the US lead this kind of arms race, a new kind of regime for arms control? There are a lot of question marks in that, and the power projection of the US, I would say. So you can always say that with Europe, of course, now there will be a huge pressure to decrease defense spending and we will come back into this problems that we have had before. But I'm not so sure about that, because there is, I would say, in Europe with COVID-19, it's kind of an awakening in a different sense that, you know, what is this world that we are moving into? What's happening now? You can continue to see these this deconstruction from the American side. But when will this turn, and at what point, and what are we, you know, what will we hook into? I think those are the big questions that we have, and I'm not sure that it will result in decreased defense spending in Europe. It might be a more of an alert feeling that, you know, we are really under pressure here from various parts of the world, and we need to look after our own house.
You know, I think that's a very interesting response, Anna. That could be a discussion even of, just on its own, in terms of trying to figure out what the future looks like without a playbook at all. But, you know, I wanted just to throw one more point in to talk about what Steve was just talking about in terms of a trilateral type of negotiation about stability, et cetera, in the future. Another aspect in thinking about 5 years out, 10 years out, as we think we can pull China into a three-way discussion, it could be by that time China and Russia are looking askance at one another too. I don't feel that they are natural friends. I don't think there's a special relationship between the two. I think they both plot when it's in their interest to plot, and it could be 10 years from now, as much cooperation and collaboration that we might be seeing now and in the next couple of years, it could be by then that one or the other is a little nervous about that relationship. And so given that, maybe they might be more amenable to bringing them in, if it was China looking at Russia or Russia looking at China even more, that they would be even more in favor of a trilateral talk because they don't feel confident enough in that Sino-Russian relationship. So it's be interesting to see what the dynamics would be, the algebraic equation 10 years from now that actually might lend itself to the three of us talking.
Yeah, Jim, I would actually agree to that. I think, certainly there's been a lot of tactical cooperation between Moscow and Beijing. There are limitations, I believe, on how far that relationship can go.
Yeah.
And so, for example, you know, one reason why Russia continues to maintain a large stockpile of non-strategic nuclear weapons or tactical nuclear weapons, I believe that's driven as much by concerns about China as it is about NATO.
I agree.
You know, when the Russians look at Chinese conventional capabilities, and in Russia, when the demographics suggest that the Russian population is in decline, you know, they worry that they're not going to be able to compete with China on their border conventionally. So there is that tension, and you know, we should not assume that this is a relationship that's going to continue and become lockstep. In part, also because if you look at Russia's trajectory, and you look at China's trajectory, Russia would be the junior partner in that relationship.
That's right.
And I don't believe that the Kremlin's ego collectively could stand that.
That's exactly right. And I think that would be where that dynamic would play, is where all of a sudden in Moscow, they realize that, you know, pulling the Chinese into some kind of agreement might be in their best interests.
Yeah. I think we're not there yet though, right? Because the Russians have publicly announced that they wouldn't be willing to pressure the Chinese. They're selling the S-400s and the early warning missile defense system. So, I mean, the challenge is how do we get through this period where their interests are increasingly aligned, and maybe the full reality from Moscow's perspective about what that future as a junior partner means hasn't entirely sunk in.
Yeah.
But that's an interesting point, Andrea, because if you go back to 2011, the Russian view, including expressed by Foreign Minister Lavrov, was that the next negotiation after New START should be multilateral. Now, my guess is the Russians were thinking not just of China, but they were also thinking of Britain and France. But it's interesting to me is that it's only been in the last year that the Russians have kind of backed away from that. And my guess is the Russians would very much welcome a negotiation that brought in China. I think they would also try to pull in Britain and France as well. You know, but they saw the Trump administration get out in front on this, and their decision was, well, let's stand back and let the Americans do the heavy lifting on this issue. So we won't pressure them, but if the Americans succeed, that works out for us.
Yeah.
But one thing along this line too, because I think as people are thinking through particularly the Russia-China relationship and looking for kind of little mini wedges or fissures in the relationship, Steve and Anna, I wonder like how much arms control is one of those issues. Earlier, you were talking, Steve, about having separate negotiations on strategic stability with Russia and China. Is there a way that you can kind of use that as a wedge issue between them? Do you think that that is a way of sowing some mistrust between the two if we're having keeping them separate and kind of sowing some uncertainty about what's going on in those parallel negotiations? Is that a way to kind of put some limits on Russia-China relations to put the brakes on or at least lessen or mitigate the extent to which they're willing to cooperate on these issues?
Yeah, I guess I'm not sure that I would use strategic stability talks with Russia, and if you could have them with China as well, to try to drive wedges. I think those would be really a mechanism to try to address those concerns and see if you could identify some areas of negotiation where you could come up with an agreement that would satisfy both sides' concerns. You also, though, bear in mind, and this can be done in parallel, there is this P5 engagement. The United States, Russia, China, Britain, and France have had a dialogue that goes back now a number of years on nuclear weapons issues. It still hasn't made a great deal of progress, you know, but there is that channel, and there's the question, could you use that P5 mechanism in a more proactive way to come up with some sort of multilateral arrangements that might not result in, for example, a specific agreement limiting each side, but are there sort of steps that would begin to head in that direction?
I guess one kind of lingering question, it's taking us back in our conversation a little bit, but when we're getting at some of the practical implications of a U.S. withdrawing from New START or from the Open Skies Treaty, you know, one of the benefits of that treaty, as we talked about, is the early indicators and warning. So we use those overflights to be able to understand, particularly in Northern and Northeastern Europe, what Russia may be doing so that NATO can respond more quickly and rapidly. Are there other kind of practical implications of the U.S. withdraw from the Open Skies Treaty? And I guess I put that against this backdrop of the question that I think most of the Russia watching community gets when President Putin's popularity is struggling at home, you know, with COVID, with this vulnerable moment of trying to reset term limits. Putin's public approval has gone way down. And the question the Russia community is always getting then is Putin willing to be more assertive internationally along his borders? So are there concerns, Anna, in Europe about what Putin may be willing to do? And then, you know, to what extent then is the U.S. withdrawal from the Open Skies Treaty then, you know, further hurting the NATO's ability to respond quickly to anything that Russia may be doing?
Yeah, I think definitely we are concerned in Northern Europe because this is just a situation for Russia, perhaps not coming months because they are apparently also fighting the pandemic crisis and might be a bit too much with the fall in the crude oil prices and so on to do something at the very low point that they would reach. But, you know, coming up after that, I would really look out for the possibility that Russia would try some kind of external adventure in order to perhaps deal with critique against the Putin regime domestically. That is always the risk of a tactical move that could involve then, for instance, Belarus or Ukraine or any of those countries. We have seen how Russia has in these months, March, April, May, done a lot of overflights, which have resulted in response from NATO interceptions, also more presence in the North Sea and so on. So they are testing the readiness, of course. I don't think they will do something immediately, but there is always this this risk of in that area. And of course, the open skies, the U.S. leaving the open skies does not send a signal that, you know, you should be more cautious because it opens up more space. And always when it opens up more space or there is a vacuum, that's something that Russia can use in an asymmetric way to move forward its position. So it does, as I said initially, also it creates great uncertainty for this region if the U.S. withdraws from the Open Skies Treaty. It might not be the whole puzzle, but it's part of the puzzle, and it would be negative for us.
Steve, did you want to add anything there?
Yeah, I mean, I think we do have to watch just make sure that we understand what the Russians are doing. But I also do wonder if perhaps the excitement for the Russian public of these foreign adventures might be diminishing. I mean, certainly the seizure of Crimea was popular for a variety of reasons, but you haven't seen the same level of enthusiasm, and it seems to be fading for the Russian military action in Donbass. My guess is that Syria is no longer seen as a big positive. So as Putin thinks through how he deals with these questions, I just wonder if there may be limitations as to what he can do on the foreign side that might distract the population from both the ongoing health crisis, but also the very real economic consequences, which I think the IMF projection is that the Russian economy will contract by 5.5-6% this year. Other economists have said 10%. Putin may have to instead think about what does he do to stimulate the economy to address the domestic side of things, as opposed to coming up with some overseas show to try to divert attention.
The only asterisk we can put that next to that, though, is the announcements about Russian planes headed into Libya. Yes. And so there, I mean, just lots of open questions. I agree. I think that's probably an entirely separate conversation from our one today. But Jim, I know you've got, Jim always likes to end, as our Brussels Sprouts listeners will know, with some of these more kind of sentimental, reflective questions. So Jim, over to you.
Sentimental. Well, there is a little sentimental, I guess. I think that's a good way to put it. So Steve, I first heard of you and learned of you back in the 90s when I was working in the Pentagon on NATO enlargement and PFP and all of that kind of thing. And of course, you were doing Ukraine at the time. But that was very much part of our discussion as well. It's a wonderful thing for me personally to have you on this show and to talk to you, you were so important in those days as we were crafting PFP and as we were trying to put together this Europol free and at peace, as we used to say in the 1990s, when anything was possible. It was a great decade, except for the Balkans, but in terms of post-Cold War, it was a wonderful time of high aspirations and relief that the Cold War was over and a lot of joy of looking into the future of what we thought we could bring about. And of course, that didn't quite happen. But let me ask you, you've had such a tremendous career. What, as you finish up your career at the State Department and as you're now still, so much involved in U.S. foreign policy in different ways, what's your takeaway now, generally? You started off as a young man in the Foreign Service in your A-100 class and rose up through the ranks and time has passed. What are some great truths that have come to you now as a result of all that experience?
Yeah. Well, first of all, let me say Foreign Service was a fantastic career. I would recommend it to anybody. It gives you a chance, first of all, it's public service. It gives you a chance to engage on some really unique issues, which you can't engage on in the private world. So, for example, one of the things that led me to look at the Foreign Service was I got very interested in college in arms control. Well, you can write about arms control in the outside world, but you've got to be in the government to do it. It gives you an opportunity to do a lot of really interesting things. I guess one caution I would have you have to understand what diplomacy is about. A good colleague of mine, Ambassador Dan Fried, used to say, and I think he's exactly right,
yeah,
is diplomacy is mostly about process and avoiding disaster.
Yeah.
And so... I look back on the period of the 90s when I was fortunate enough to be at the Clinton White House and then to be in Kyiv. And that was really a time of opportunity where you could really do some things. It was not avoiding disaster, but trying to do some things that would mean a big change. And what we were trying to do was move in a very fine, fixed way beyond the Cold War. And so I remember when we looked at Europe, when I was on the National Security Council with President Clinton, there were sort of three tracks. There was the NATO enlargement track, the idea of bringing in countries, and that would promote this idea of a Europol and free. There was a NATO-Russia track, the goal of which was to try to build a NATO-Russia relationship that was so cooperative that the Russians would no longer see NATO as a threat. They wouldn't care about enlargement. Right. And then there was a third track, the NATO-Ukraine track, to make Ukraine feel that it was not somehow abandoned in this gray zone between an enlarging NATO and Russia. And I guess looking back now, 20-odd years later, we were successful on two of the three tracks. I think on the Russia track, perhaps looking back with some hindsight, we were overly optimistic on how quickly we could change Russian attitudes. And we probably underestimated just how much antipathy there was in Moscow towards NATO, even when by the mid-90s, it was pretty clear that NATO was not an organization hostile to Russia.
Right.
And I think it's a missed opportunity, and There may have been some things that we could have done on the American and the NATO side that might have increased the prospects of that relationship working. I think there were some things that the Russians could have done as well.
Right.
But it was a chance, I think, to reshape some things. And I guess I would argue that looking at Europe today, despite the difficulties, it's been good for Europe, in terms of bringing the continent closer together. We still have to deal with this question of a Russia that clearly is unhappy with the way Europe has developed over the last 20 years.
Well, thank you very much. What Dan Fried said is right. I used to think of working this stuff as like being at the coal face with a big hammer, and you every day you're just chipping away at the coal face and going home the next night and then eventually passing the hammer off to someone else.
Well, thanks to both of you, Anna and Steve. This arms control is a kind of niche topic. And so thanks for breaking it down and making it accessible to a non-expert community, helping us all understand why it's so important for the United States and for Europe. So thank you both for joining us. And we hope we get to do it again soon.
It was great to see you all. Thank you.
Yeah, great to see you.
Thank you.